Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Douglas Brinkley is an author, professor, commentator, and historian. He's written and co-authored dozens of books on topics as diverse as Rosa Parks, Jimmy Carter, Walter Cronkite, and Hunter S. Thompson. Doug's latest book is American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. He talks this hour with author John Bacon. John asked Doug how growing up in Perrysburg, Ohio, made him feel connected to the first moon landing.
When I was little, my mom and dad both made me, like everybody of a certain age, really watch that big moment when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And we would sleep in a sleeping bag and wait to just see that historic moment. But it always impressed me that Neil Armstrong, the first astronaut on the moon, was from Wapakoneta, Ohio, not that far from Perrysburg. And I ended up, some years later, I wrote a book on Dean Acheson, Harry Truman's Secretary of State, and then a book on James Forrestal, who was Secretary of the Navy, first Secretary of Defense. And I had the temerity to autograph each of these books of mine, and I sent them to Neil Armstrong at his P.O. box on a farm outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. And I got a polite blow-off in the mail. It was from his assistant that said, Mr. Armstrong is not doing interviews, and he'll read one of the books you sent him. And it was only years later that I got a call from NASA, and I was asked to actually do the oral history interview of Neil Armstrong for NASA. And the date for it was scheduled was right in late September of 2001. And what does that tell you? You know, I was watching 9/11 on television and watched that unfold. And I got a hold of my contact at NASA and said, oh, I guess we have to reschedule the interview with Neil Armstrong. He said, no, Neil doesn't cancel anything. I said, well, how are we getting there? Because airports were all shut. And he said, well, he's going to fly himself in. So I drove from New Orleans to Houston and waited, and Neil Armstrong landed his own plane, walked out, sat on a table like this, and allowed me to spend 8 hours with him talking about his entire life. So for me, it was getting to know a boyhood hero. Out of that interview, I started thinking about writing this book, American Moonshot, and it got further along when the fact that I teach at Rice, where on September 12, 1962, John F. Kennedy gave that incredible speech where he said, we choose to go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And then talked about public discovery, meaning all of us, Americans, taking part in going to the moon. And he said that our solar system is the new ocean and the new sea, and our astronauts were the new Columbuses and Magellans. And it was done at a football stadium at Rice with 35,000 people, right where my history office is. And the NASA lore in Houston, Texas is quite thick, as you can imagine. So the combo of this made me realize I'm going to go ahead and write the story of why and how the United States went to the moon in 1969.
And as I said, as an amateur historian, that is a very gutsy move. So write another book about George Washington. Good luck with that. It's been written about, but he pulled it off. That's incredible. In Brinkley's telling of history, it is not inevitable. Individuals did matter, and so did particular moments on which history, in fact, did pivot. And for the five of the guys I want to highlight here, first one is a surprise, perhaps, from the preface and the first chapter, Jules Verne, who actually figures into the story on the moonshot.
Do any of you remember the French novelist Jules Verne? Well, he wrote a book after the American Civil War, like right after it, from Paris, in which he predicted that the first people to go to the moon will be Americans, and it will happen pretty close to the time when it did in the 20th century, and that they would it would take 8 days to go from Earth to the moon and back, and it did take 8 days. And that it would have like parts of a rocket that would break off, and The one that kills me is he said they would leave from Tampa Bay, Florida. And we, of course, left from Cape Canaveral, Florida. But that's how prescient Jules Verne was as a science fiction novelist. And he had a big influence on John F. Kennedy as a boy, and Neil Armstrong, John Glenn. They all had read that novel by Jules Verne, and it spurred them to dream about the moon and Mars and beyond.
Surprising tie-in there, but one of his great lines in the book is that artists are often ahead of the scientists and the politicians in dreaming bigger things that we end up doing through those other fields. But it happened in that case, of course.
The great novelist Kurt Vonnegut from Indiana was a friend of mine who wrote Slaughterhouse, and Vonnegut used to talk about the history of engineering and tinkering in America, that Yankee ingenuity. And Vonnegut, though, was worried that when we went to the moon, it was going to be a doomsday prophecy, because he got worried that we were neglecting Earth while we were building all these rockets and missiles.
Did not know about that. JFK, of course, was a big dreamer. I had a chance to get to know Herb Brooks, who's the hockey coach who beat the Soviets in 1980. And while we're doing a book on his life, of course, and his career, he was asking me, what's your favorite movie? And of course, I said Casablanca, because that is the correct answer. And I said, okay, I'll bite. What's yours? And he said, and I could not believe this, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And I looked up and said, you're the meanest man I know. That can't be possible. And he said, it's because we've forgotten how to dream. And Herb Brooks dreamed about what happened in Lake Placid in 1960 when he was cut from the team, 20-year dream. JFK's dream was pretty much along those lines. This was a dream he held from Jules Verne, from his ocean studies and whatnot.
Well, I begin a lot of my book with John F. Kennedy. He's born in Brookline, Massachusetts in 1917. And, we all know the story of Kennedy and his wealthy father. But that, when you're born in 1917, it means you're born in a new age, the age of flight. The Wright brothers were in 1903 at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. It took a while to perfect the airplane. World War I became the great incubator for aviation. So when you're born in 1917, you're a child of the skies. And in fact, just like in our childhoods or when we were younger, we would have shows like The Jetsons and Lost in Space or Star Trek. Back in the 1920s and early 30s, on radio, Buck Rogers and, Flash Gordon became captivated people's imaginations. And CBS in the 1920s would do radio broadcast about going to the moon. And not far from where Kennedy was born in Massachusetts, a man named Dr. Robert Goddard, a professor at Clark University, decided that the way to break the whole game on space was to how do you get up a projectile up ahead of 62 miles from Earth? How do you break the Earth's gravity grip and put something into space? Nobody's ever done it before. Goddard had dreams of doing it, and he would launch these rockets in a cabbage field in Auburn, Massachusetts, and he'd get written up for noisemaking and disturbing the peace. The New York Times wrote a really nasty article about his quackery as a scientist and should he be allowed to teach at a college. And they apologized about 50 years later because it was some of Goddard's principles is what took us to the moon in 1969. We couldn't fund rocketeers in America. Charles Lindbergh, 1927, transatlantic flight. Lindbergh found Goddard some money. But when the Great Depression hit in 1929, it ended up being that Goddard couldn't afford to stay in Massachusetts and moved out to New Mexico, Roswell, New Mexico. So when you hear about space aliens and the like, they weren't crazy out in New Mexico. There were things going out from his Eden Valley Ranch that were putting in the sky. But that was about it in the United States in the 1920s and 30s. We didn't have top rocketeers. The country that did was Germany. And in the Weimar Republic in Germany, they had great rocketeers. And in my book, I write about somebody, a rough contemporary of JFK, who becomes the top German rocket scientist, and that's Wernher von Braun. And he ended up not leaving Germany when Hitler came to power and actually becoming an SS officer for the Third Reich and it became Hitler's top program was to build rockets to destroy London, Antwerp, and other cities to win World War II. We put our money into a Manhattan Project for atomic weapons, but Hitler went on these vengeance weapons, and the V-2 in particular would start arcing 210 miles. You would launch it from the Netherlands, and they did all sorts of havoc and destruction in London. And as I tell in the book, towards the end of the war, von Braun is the most wanted asset by the United States government. We want von Braun and his technology, and we get it because once Hitler committed suicide in his bunker in Berlin, von Braun realized if he got arrested by the British, he'd be tried for war crimes against London and killing of civilians with his bombs or missiles. But also, they used Jewish labor at the Dora camp to build the vengeance weapons. That's a subcamp of Buchenwald, some of the most horrendous Holocaust conditions imaginable. So von Braun made a deal he took 137 German Nazi rocket scientists, took two train cars, packed it with with blueprints and moved all of the vengeance weapons, the missile technology, to a cave, hit it, then hit in the Bavarian Alps and sent his baby brother to put his hands up and surrender to the U.S. Army. And a private from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, encountered Magnus von Braun, and he said, "My brother's the Werner von Braun." And a deal was made with the U.S. Army under Operation Paperclip, under Harry Truman, their president's order, to move all 137 of the German top rocketeers to Fort Bliss in Texas, El Paso. And they were called prisoners of peace. And they started working to build missiles and rockets in the United States. They get moved to Huntsville, Alabama in 1950. It's Rocket City, USA. And in my book, I document Kennedy and von Braun's meeting in 1953. And it's von Braun who built the Saturn V that took us to the moon, Hitler's rocketeer.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Doug Brinkley talks about how the Cold War contributed to the space race.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to John Bacon's conversation with Doug Brinkley.
JFK figures prominently. He has the subtitle, of course, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. I've read plenty on Kennedy. Probably you have too. It's the most supple biography I've read about Kennedy so far. Things about him I never knew about him. And also what a vulnerable guy he often was, that he was not the guy, of course, picked for greatness. His brother was. His rise to power was not at all inevitable, despite his dad's money and power. And he defied the odds again and again and again to get to the White House, of course, and then within that realm to champion NASA, to create the NASA that we know today. So his story is an amazing one, and I was shocked to learn that his ties also to this involve his brother's death and his own feeling that his own life will not be that long.
Well, John F. Kennedy served very nobly in World War II in the South Pacific. Some of you might know the Solomon Islands campaign and the famous PT-109 incident when Kennedy's boat split in half, runs in at night into a Japanese ship. Crewmen die, Kennedy saves lives, and he becomes a war hero, young John F. Kennedy. And he came back to America, and he would run for Congress. You know, the one thing I want you to know about John F. Kennedy, you all think of him as an orator or handsome, debonair, or whatever you think of him. But he hated losing. He never lost. His dad used to browbeat him if he got a second place in a boat race. Who got number one? We don't do second. And So John F. Kennedy in his political career never lost an election. He won Congress in 1946 from Massachusetts, again in 1948, again in 1950. He ran for the Senate in 1952 and ran and won. He ran for the Senate in 1958 and won, and he ran for the presidency in 1960, our youngest elected president in American history. That's the kind of hubris John F. Kennedy had and drive that he had. But his brother was his hero, and his brother was a naval aviator in Europe for the U.S., and his brother died in Operation Aphrodite, in which we would take Navy planes and pack it with TORPACs, which is like TNT, from nose, you know, to tail, and Kennedy flew it, and it was aiming to be like a drone and to crash into the warehouse sites of Wernher von Braun's vengeance weapons, and his brother blew up in the sky. He was going to parachute out the last minute, but something happened. Wire loose or whatever, and it went. We could barely find any even rubble. And so Kennedy lost his brother trying to take out Wernher von Braun's missiles. And here they are. They meet in 1953 together as Time Magazine's judges for Person of the Year. And all Kennedy did when he went out around New York with von Braun is kept talking about how his brother died trying to destroy your missiles. And they became great friends. And they chose Konrad Adenauer as Time's Man of the Year. He was the new chancellor of West Germany. And the reason why von Braun got kind of whitewashed in America, people weren't holding him accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity. He did a PR job. His first speech he gave in El Paso, Texas, von Braun, was to the Rotary Club, where he talked about going to the moon and Mars. He hit his World War II experience, and then Walt Disney discovered him and put von Braun on his TV show throughout the 1950s. And von Braun became the space guy of tomorrow, and Kennedy saw him as a space celebrity. And Dwight Eisenhower, president, didn't like von Braun because of his Nazi past, but Kennedy figured, I was a young guy, I fought in the Pacific for America, he's German, he fought for Germany, and our new big allies in the Cold War of the 1950s are Japan and West Germany. So he held no grudge against von Braun.
It's an amazing story there, too. Amazing relationship right to the very end. They're very close. Two unsung heroes, largely, are LBJ and James Webb. He'll talk about that, I'm sure. But, of course, the sung heroes are the astronauts. What was great about reading about their biographies in your book, fresh stuff, original stuff, even if you read the right stuff and so on, this is new material. These guys were absolutely the real deal. And in our line of work, of course, he interviews astronauts, and I investigate Notre Dame football players. So it turns out the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Grantland Rice's famous lead, are pestilence. What do we have here? Famine, pestilence, destruction, and death. I looked up that game. They beat Army 13-7. That is not death and destruction. That's two field goals. It's not that impressive. I'm sorry. So sometimes you look back in the past and you find out it's not that big a deal. In this case, when you look back at these guys and you interview these guys as well, these guys are absolutely the real deal. Character, toughness, intelligence, amazing resilience, and actual real togetherness.
Well, they are astronaut core. I mean, the key point, as you all know, is the Cold War. And from 1945 to 1949, it's the only time in world history where one country has a nuclear monopoly, the United States. And we felt good. We're the superpower. We have nuclear weapons. Nobody else does. And lo and behold, the Soviet Union got the atomic bomb. And then they got the hydrogen bomb. And the Russians put up the first intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, the R-7. And then, in October 1957, they put up the first satellite with Sputnik in October. And Sputnik was the size of a basketball with big antenna that went around, and America panicked. We are losing everything to Russia. There still was no human in space, but we felt there was a missile. John F. Kennedy, as a senator, creates the term missile gap with Russia, space lag. And the Democrats, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and others beat up on Eisenhower for being asleep at the wheel and force Eisenhower in 1958 to create NASA as civilian space exploration. And by 1959, we're ready to name who our first space travelers were be, and it's the Mercury 7 astronauts. Life magazine told their life stories, and there was grand introductions of their things. They became like knights of American exceptionalism to prove that the United States was as good as the Soviet Union in technology, that democratic capitalism was equal and better than totalitarian communism. But yet we never put a astronaut into space in the late 50s, and Kennedy runs on space. The famous Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960 were the first presidential debates in U.S. history. Lincoln Douglas is an Illinois game, you know. The only time presidents debated was 60, and it was on television, and there were four, and the Kennedy scores his best points on space against Nixon. At one point, he says to Nixon, "You told Mr. Khrushchev," the Soviet premier, "you told Mr. Khrushchev that the United States is number one in kitchen appliances, and we have color TV. Well, I'll take my TV in black and white, thank you. I want to be number one in rocket thrust." And then another moment in the debate, Kennedy says to Nixon, "If you're elected, I see a Soviet flag planted on the moon. I want an American flag planted on the moon." And Kennedy gets elected by a hair in 1960. He does that famous Ask Not inaugural you all know. And then lo and behold, in April 61, only a couple months in the White House, the Soviets put the first human in space, Yuri Gagarin, cosmonaut. And it happens on Jack Kennedy's watch, and he's livid. And in White House meetings, he is really browbeating his national security advisor and aides. How do we leapfrog the Soviets? I want to leapfrog them. We've got to do something big to beat them in space. And he also pushed to finally get a Mercury astronaut up because we were worried about some of the tech, whether we didn't want a dead astronaut, to put it bluntly. And we, on May 5th, 1961, put our first counterstatement to Gagarin, and that's Mercury astronaut Alan Shepard of New Hampshire, whose family hailed from the Mayflower. Shepard's only up 15 minutes, comes down, and he becomes an overnight folk hero. And it's that very month of May 61, on the 25th, that Kennedy surprises Americans, goes to a joint session of Congress in Washington, and makes the pledge, we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade and bring him back alive. And you know what they thought at NASA? You got to be kidding me. We've got no technology to go to the moon. Dwight Eisenhower, for ex-president now, called it a $40 billion stunt. It was $25 billion stunt, but he said it'll be a $40 billion stunt and criticized it. And McGeorge Bundy, Kennedy's own national security advisor, pigeonholed his boss and said, "What are you doing saying we're going to the moon?" And Kennedy said, "Mac, you've got to have some moxie to run for president in your 40s. John F. Kennedy's father was desperately looking for a son after the speech, calling the White House secretary, "Where's Jack? God damn it, I knew he'd do something dumb and reckless like this." Kennedy is now leading this. During his presidency, we put up six Mercury missions. Mercury is all one astronaut. Gemini is two, Apollo three, the goal, the moon. And while Kennedy's alive, we put up six Mercury missions. Six of those Mercury 7 go up, only Deke Slayton didn't. And they all became space heroes, the most famous being John Glenn of Ohio, but there's also Gordon Cooper and Wally Schirra and Scott Carpenter and Gus Grissom, and they all became Kennedy's Space Corps. Kennedy loved special ops. He created the U.S. SEALs. He created the Green Beret. And he had these now Mercury astronauts, which were he saw as almost an extension of his presidency.
Like I said, see? It's an amazing story because we think we know it, but we don't. And how we got to the starting line, really, with Apollo, just to get that far was an amazing story. I didn't realize it. I knew we were behind, of course, Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin. I didn't realize they were basically behind for 6 or 7 years, constantly. Every first was the Soviets, not the Americans, of course. So get this, I also didn't realize this. Yuri Gagarin, Bay of Pigs, and Alan Shepard's first flight all occur within 24 days. That is a busy month. And you get some sense of how tense the whole experience was. And of course, during Jack Kennedy's presidency alone, you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Wall, the airlift, all this happens. So the sideshow basically is the Apollo program. So this is how we express ourselves during this time. So I got it. You already mentioned one of them. Delicious details. These are the things that, thank God, Douglas did not cut, because I know he had to cut a lot of stuff to make this book work. But here's a fun one. The phrase moonshot comes from baseball. Explain.
Well, we all use the term moonshot, and it began in the late 1950s with a baseball player named Wally Moon of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And he was playing in the L.A. Coliseum, and they would hit these towering home runs over the, you know, left field fence. And Vince Scully, a radio announcer, would go, "There it is, going back. It's a moonshot." And it became popularized out in Los Angeles with the broadcasting and got picked up nationally. NASA starts using the term for their manned space center in Houston, which is determined in the early 60s, that's it. And it first is called the Moonshot Command Post. Today we call it the Johnson Manned Space Center in NASA. But the term moonshot now, on the 50th anniversary, stands for American can-doism. And everybody's hoping, the idea that our society can pull together instead of this Democrat-Republican divide and all the ugliness, we work together as Americans, do something big short of war. So, you know, Buzz Aldrin, I was just with Michael Collins, one of the Apollo 11 astronauts. They think the next moonshot needs to be a Mars shot, where we go to Mars. Joe Biden, running for president right now, wants the new moonshot to be a war on cancer. There are people that say the new moonshot should be an Earth shot to deal with climate change. I can go on. The point is that word now means pulling together and getting something big done as Americans that unites our country and doesn't divide us.
And it starts with Wally Moon. He mentioned, of course, and I did not realize this, that the first presidential debates were, in fact, 1960, not as televised. I learned that, of course, but first ever. That was amazing to me. Here are some fun facts for you from the NASA training. They pounded jets of ice water fired into their ears at 10-second intervals. That'll weed out a lot of guys right there. And perhaps the most shocking one, all these guys had to swallow a 2-foot rubber hose. I got a lot of jokes, but I'm not going to tell them. But that shows you the guys who survived this process. It sounds like frat hazing at some point, honestly. So.
The endurance tests were brutal to be a Mercury or Gemini or Apollo astronaut. But I just to pivot off that, I write in my book, you know, we've had 12 moonwalkers now after Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, others followed. But we still have yet to have a woman on the moon. So when we go back, we need to have the first woman on the moon. And that may be. And I write in my book about the Mercury 13. 13 women did train to become astronauts. They were extraordinary pilots, and they passed all of Dr. Randy Lovelace's endurance tests. In fact, many of them had better statistics of endurance than the male astronauts. John Glenn was in a weird league of his own. It's a whole other story. I don't know. He's like his meaning your pulse, your heart rate, and all of this. But the last minute, no, they wouldn't allow the women on gender bias back then. There were people in the Kennedy administration saying, let's put a woman into space. John Glenn testified at a subcommittee, no, we don't want women. And the trick of keeping women out of becoming astronauts was you had to have logged military aviation, combat experience, and flight experience. Well, if women weren't allowed to be pilots in the military in the Korean War, you couldn't log those hours, so they found a way not to have them. So unfortunately, Russia got another first. They put the first woman astronaut in space. But we went into space with a woman, Sally Ride, some of you remember? What a great person she was. She went up in 1983, and then now it's not just a cracked glass ceiling for women, it's shattered. There are women astronauts all over. It's a robust field for going to college and study aeronautics or space science. dream of being an astronaut. It's equal for women now, but it took a long time to get to that point. So we do come a long ways with things. And when we hear about going back to the moon in 4 or 5 years or 8 years, I'm sure we will have a female moonwalker, which would only be right.
Some more delicious details. On page 182, Al Kaline. That's all I have to say about that. That's called pandering again. Barden's Wonder Freeze, Al Kaline. I'm sure I'll have one more here. John Glenn's wingman during the Korean War, none other than Ted Williams, the famous hitter, who is, of course, quite a good pilot himself, as was well known. So back to the story itself. February 20th, 1962, the 14th attempt by John Glenn to take the launch itself. That's how many times it was scratched before that, scrubbed as they call it in the business. That was a momentous day, and your depiction of this had me gripped.
Well, John Glenn, finally got a green light, and his reason, he was the Marine of the Mercury astronauts. You know, they tried to not get jealousy between the armed service branches, so you'd go Navy, Air Force, Army, Marine, trying to keep them all involved, and he was the Marine, John Glenn. But he went up in early 62 and almost died. He circled Earth 5 times, but upon re-entry, we lost communication with him and the heat shield started coming out. I'm not exaggerating that he lost like 15 pounds in space from sweating so much. He came back totally dehydrated. It was like an inferno inside that little capsule, the Friendship 7. And once he's back, he is a ticker tape parade, giant hero. 1962 is the year that Seattle has its World's Fair and the Space Needle goes up. And we're all talking about space in America. And Glenn, politically, was an independent. Kennedy once was in a rocking chair in the White House with the astronauts, and out of nowhere, he said to the Mercury 7 were there, and Kennedy says, "So I hear you guys, except for Glenn, are Republicans." And they all looked at each other, and Gus Grissom said, "I don't know what the hell we are. We're just like a motley bunch." And they laughed, but Kennedy globs on to John Glenn, and he becomes almost an extended member of the Kennedy family. He becomes Bobby Kennedy's great pal. Glenn becomes a Democratic senator eventually from Ohio. But when I interviewed Ethel Kennedy, the widow of RFK, Bobby Kennedy, when Bobby was murdered in Los Angeles and laying there, Sirhan killed him, she has to leave her husband's dead body there with blood all over and quickly sneaks a telephone call in. And you know who she called? John Glenn. She called Glenn to go to Hickory Hill, her home in Northern Virginia, to look after her children because he had become like a family member and had such a calm demeanor about him that he would be able to talk to her children while she was having to deal with that horrific event there. So Glenn and Kennedy, and they used to travel around. Bobby and Ethel Kennedy and the Glenns would go to Palm Springs and Florida together on trips. They had become that close.
On that attempt, of course, that one worked, the 14th try. John Glenn called his wife beforehand, this is from the book, of course, and said, "Don't be scared. Remember, I'm just going down to the corner store to get a pack of gum." These guys truly had ice in their veins, and despite that inferno, as you describe, his heart rate did not increase. That's what these guys were made of, naturally. How much did it grip America? 45 million TVs, about a third of the country at that point, was tuned into this. In Detroit, the employees at Bell Telephone thought that the machines were not working because no calls were being made. They're all watching the launch, of course. In Grand Rapids, a judge and a jury were adjudicating on a stolen television case, and while the perpetrator was there, they turned the TV on to watch the launch. So, why wouldn't you do that, right? We'll take 5 minutes here.
And you know what? Also, John, when at that same time, everybody's watching Walter Cronkite on CBS News, and when the reporters swarmed, it was nail-biting, like whether Glenn died or not, and he's alive and he's saved, and the reporters swarmed around John Glenn's mother, and they said, "Oh my God, are you so excited to meet and reunite with your son? And she said, well, I'm really excited I'm going to get to meet Walter Cronkite.
I need to add here, by the way, Douglas also wrote a best-selling book about Walter Cronkite, so he knows his turf.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of John Bacon's conversation with Doug Brinkley, author of American Moonshot.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to John Bacon's conversation with Douglas Brinkley.
My all-time favorite, though, same day, same launch. In Trenton, New Jersey, a bank robber successfully robbed a bank of $9,000 on his way out. He decides to stop at a bar. The launch is on TV. Heck, I'll watch this. And while he's watching, he gets caught. So that's how it captivated the nation. One last one, and this is, by the way, doing what I do for a living, trying to do what Doug does, of course. The level of research and detail is phenomenal, and knowing what to keep in and what to put in the archives, of course. In 1962, the Mets, brand new team, of course, New York Mets, replacing the Dodgers and the Giants from 5 years earlier, are coached by Casey Stengel, of course, known for his irascible personality. You not only mentioned that they're in spring training working on something, but they're doing the leadoff play, how to do the leadoff play. That level of detail is incredible. And during the leadoff play drill, he says, let's take a break and watch the launch. That team lost 120 games that year. So I don't think it mattered too much, ultimately. A big shocker to me. So we all hear about the space race, of course, and so on. I did not know that several times JFK reached out privately and publicly to the Soviets to try to pull this thing off together. So it might not have been a race, it might have been cooperation at some point, but Khrushchev always said no.
Well, and the reason what Kennedy got worried about after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we almost went to war, a nuclear war perhaps with Russia, I don't know if you realize that the Cuban Missile Crisis got defused because Bobby Kennedy met with the Soviet ambassador and made a deal that in a year, if they would not dismantle their launch sites in Cuba, Russia, we would remove our Jupiter missiles from Turkey that were pointed at the Soviet Union. Those were Wernher von Braun Jupiter missiles there in Turkey. And many of the Vanguard missiles built by the Navy used to collapse. If you see them on footage, you'll see them collapse. Von Braun's rockets, whether a Jupiter or a Saturn, they were always flawlessly engineered. And big takeaway from the reason that the Soviets didn't want to do anything, I mentioned that Khrushchev's son, Sergei Khrushchev, I asked my dad, would we really, Dad, go to the moon with America? And Khrushchev said, never. And the son said, why? And Khrushchev said, because then the Americans will know what we don't have. We filmed our launches. Everything Russia did was in secret at Star City and in Kazakhstan. And so they were boasting a lot about their technology, Russia, when all of it wasn't really what they said it was going to be, in a collaborative effort would not have been in their interest. And in the United States, it would have gotten defunded if we went with Russia, because we were selling it for Cold War politics. It cost $25 billion for the Apollo project. That's $180 billion today. And the reason it's so bipartisan is Democrats like big government projects. FDR, the Grand Coulee Dam, and Tennessee Valley Authority, and dams and the like. You have Dwight Eisenhower built the interstate highway system, the St. Lawrence Seaway. Kennedy puts it all on space and technology corridors around the country. So Democrats are into it. Republicans don't want to be seen as weak on communism. So if Kennedy wanted to tell a Republican senator, oh, you don't want to go to the moon? So you want the Soviets to beat us to the moon, Senator? No, I didn't say that. I didn't, you know, in that Cold War climate, it pulled everybody together. And Kennedy sold it, you're talking about sports a lot, at my university. I read the original draft of Kennedy's speech, and he writes in on his own at the last minute, you know, they say, why do we go to the moon? Why did Mallory climb Mount Everest? Why does Rice play Texas in football? It's a challenge, you know, and but he would frame it in kind of football win metaphors in his speeches in order to keep that funding going. And when Kennedy's assassinated in Dallas in 1963, he was on his way to give a speech about space, how many satellites we have put up, how many weather reconnaissance and telecommunications, and how we now are winning in the race of rocketry and on our way to the moon. And alas, he never got to give that speech.
He did not, of course. We know that. And we also, of course, know that he did not see the moon landing. However, in this book, Douglas has got that unread speech. In full. It's incredible. It's a beautiful speech. So in that speech, it's very clear that JFK already knew that the Americans were ahead of the Soviets in the space race. He at least saw that, and not by much, but the U.S. was definitely unequivocally ahead at that stage. And as you also wrote in this book, which also surprised me, that his death might have actually guaranteed the mission.
Well, the day before Kennedy was killed, he was in San Antonio, Texas, giving a space speech where all about the spin-off technology. Basically, if you're Kennedy's audience here, he was saying to you, you say $25 billion is a lot of money. Well, you know what? We're just in medicine alone. We're getting CAT scans and MRI, kidney dialysis machines, heart defibrillators, football, the foam and helmet hopefully reduce concussions, the suits that fire people wear for fire resistant. He rattled off all that you're getting taxpayers for your money, and it was true. Once he's killed in Dallas, the big moment, you know, Jackie Kennedy wore the pink Chanel suit and blood all over her, and, you know, she got stood when Lyndon Johnson got sworn in on Air Force One. Kennedy gets buried at Arlington National Cemetery, John Glenn participating in all of that ceremony. And then Jackie gets to meet the new president in the Oval Office her first time. Lyndon and Johnson and Lady Bird was there. And she has one request. She says to Lyndon Johnson, I want Jack's dream, the moonshot dream, alive, kept alive. And Lyndon says, we will. And he said, you know what, we decided, if it's okay with you, to Jackie, Johnson said, we want to name Kennedy, they named Cape Canaveral the Kennedy Space Center. And she said, that would be great. And then in my book, I document Jackie Kennedy's correspondence with Wernher von Braun as von Braun's racing to build the moon rocket in Huntsville, Alabama. But in the mid-1960s, on the Kennedy effect, NASA got 4.4% of our annual federal budget, 4.4%. Today, it gets a third of 1%. And so they used to say in NASA, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. And it almost gets derailed going to the moon, except particularly in 1967, when we have an Apollo 1 rocket that's going to do a test exercise, and three of our astronauts blow up in a fireball, and we lose Gus Grissom and Roger Chaffee and Ed White. And with the three dead Apollo astronauts, people rightfully were saying, why the end of the decade? What's so just because Kennedy said by the end of the decade, what's so magical about it? James Webb, who I write about, the head of NASA in the Kennedy-Johnson years, resigns. And there's a feeling Apollo might get defunded, but it had enough gas in its tank. So 50 years ago, Richard Nixon was president, and he was continuing with Apollo, and he's the president of record when we finally had that success of going to the moon. Keep in mind, as Armstrong told me, that he thought they had a 50-50 chance of being successful. Not dying, but just that they could pull it off. Now that we know it worked, we all, you know, honor it and celebrate it. But it was we lost a lot of good people in trying to, in our space program and in aviation out at test pilots out in Edwards Air Force Base and the like. And so there's a lot we need to, on the 50th, remember people who died in the space program. And we did that on the moon. Neil Armstrong, that's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. He wrote that line himself. He test marketed on his brother. What you're not going to be focused, except I might be mentioning now, is at the very end, the clock's running. They've got moon rock and lunar dust, and they got to get out of the moon and onto the Eagle and then reconnect with the mothership Columbia. You will hear at that moment Armstrong say to Aldrin, "Did you leave the packet?" And suddenly in that bulky suit, you see Aldrin left something there. On that site in the moon, incidentally, if all of our audience, we went back there today, it would look exactly like it was. There's no wind on the moon, so it would be like exactly like it was on July 20th, 1969, except the American flag, the red and blue colors of the flag have turned almost white due to ultraviolet rays. But otherwise, someday it will be a national park. It'll be like the moon-based, tranquility-based national park, where you'll see the footprints of the first time humans broke the shackles of planet Earth. But in that moment, when he said, "Did you leave the packet?" In that packet were medals honoring our Apollo 1 astronauts who had died in 67. And in that same packet were medals honoring the Soviet cosmonauts who died in their space program, including Yuri Gagarin, who later died in an aviation accident working in the space program and died there. So there's a Gagarin medal on the American site on the moon, because without Russia to compete in peace for all civilization, without the peaceful aspect of the competition, we wouldn't have funded it or gotten to the moon. So we paid our proper respects to Russia for spurring us forward.
Talk a little bit about what NASA did in fact do for us, as JFK promised, as well as the final legacy here. What NASA did not do for us, despite common misconception, and that is including mine, the NASA program did not invent Velcro, Teflon, or Tang. I don't know how much Tang I pounded as a five-year-old kid in Ann Arbor, but they did use all these things. They certainly popularized those things. However, the list, and Doug's got this in the book, the list of various fields this project did spur is incredible. You already mentioned, of course, kidney dialysis, which is amazing. Cordless power tools. We all have those. Barcoding, we use that every day, of course, in the grocery stores. And of course, naturally, computers. Computer science programs boomed across the nation during the 60s, and that is why we're also had another field, of course, high tech.
Absolutely. You know, I knew when I started my book that NASA was sort of the gateway to the technology revolution of the Silicon Valley. It also was the last act of World War II, Apollo 11. It was only 15 years after World War II ended in 1960, and there was still in our society this notion of high risk, hurry up things, collective work of academicians with the federal government, with the private sector, and it kind of got godfathered in. Although the pilots were Korean War veterans, people like Armstrong, Glenn, Shira, the management level people served in World War II, including James Webb, who was running our radar, which is a brand new World War II innovation for the Marines in the Pacific against Japan. So we got to remember that 60, when Kennedy's elected, World War II was only 15 years old. But the big technological breakthrough was in the late 50s when Texas Instruments in Dallas created a guy, Jack Kirby, the microchip there, which NASA adopts, and we start using, NASA becomes the applied science of computer technology. And as John said, in 1960, I noticed they did not have computer science classes at universities. You couldn't be a computer science major at a college, university. By 63, they were everywhere. But it was the beginning of the computer age with NASA taking the lead. And also in 1960, hate to keep telling you Time Magazine's Person of the Year, but it was scientist in 1960. There's this window of the Kennedy early, you know, that part of the 60s that our society thought scientists were gonna solve all of our problems. By the end of the 60s and early 70s, we didn't feel that way about scientists anymore because of Agent Orange and Vietnam War and Dow Chemical and Rachel Carson and DDT and its pesticides. And there became a kind of attack on the science community. So Kennedy was very lucky to be windowing this right when computer science was making this kind of moonshot plausible.
When you think back about the legacy of the moonshot, thanks to Wally Moon, of course, a few things come to mind. It's one of the few times you pointed out earlier where left and right were utterly bonded in this mission, and probably our greatest triumph period, where outside of a war, of course. War unifies us, 9/11 unifies us. This unified us without a war, without a tragedy. A positive triumph, which is pretty incredible. On the plaque, of course, in that pack, they also dropped a plaque which said, "We came in peace for all mankind." And that remains with the white flag, of course, on the moon. And one of the thoughts that Doug has near the end of the book is really, really hit me. How many times do we say in the course of a day, if we can put a man on the moon, we can blank? It is the standard for everything else we think about. If we can do that, we can do anything. That is the spirit involved. Kennedy was right about the spiritual aspect, if you will, about how it's going to affect our society forever. And it now occurs to me, too, that 1,000 years from now, if they remember American society at all, the first thing they remember is that we went to the moon. That will always be something that will be part of our history long after almost everything else. So that's a pretty incredible story, to say the least. George Will said about Ken Burns, proud Ann Arbor High graduate, that the Civil War, of course, our national tragedy, has finally found its Homer. Our greatest triumph, the American moonshot, has found its Homer as well, Douglas Brinkley.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Doug Brinkley talking with John Bacon. Doug Brinkley's latest book is called American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milkerrick.